Welcome to the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, part of the Kansas Cyclist website and the Eero Podcast Network. Podcasts that inform by focusing on the news and the people behind the news. My name is Edward Eero, and together with Randy Reza, webmaster of the Kansas Cyclist, we are your hosts for episode 14 for November 17th, 2009. In this episode, we will be interviewing Kim West, the host of the Kim West Radio Hour in Des Moines, Iowa. And we will also be talking to Tim Stansberry, one of the co-owners of Grease Monkey Wipes, our newest sponsor. Our podcast provides news and information about bicycling in Kansas and neighboring states, and is a feature of the Kansas Cyclist website, which is found at www.kansascyclist.com. Links to the Kansas Cyclist podcast can be found at the website and at the Eero Podcast Network on the web at epn.eero.com. We would like to thank our sponsors, Action Wipes, VeloCal, and now Grease Monkey Wipes, for their support. If any of our listeners are interested in becoming a sponsor of the Kansas Cyclist podcast or have general feedback on the show, please write to podcast@kansascyclist.com or call our new phone number at 913-938-6855, as we would be very interested in hearing from you. Before we get started, we want to let you know that since we are entering the off-season, that our podcast will be publishing monthly rather than bi-monthly, as we have done throughout the season. Please do subscribe, as then you will have the podcast delivered automatically. Our first area, as always, is news and information. Randy puts a lot of things up at the Kansas Cyclist website. Are there some highlights that you'd like to let us know here in episode 14?
Well, this time of year, bicycling news gets a little slow, and on top of that, I've been focusing on some other stuff recently. So if you've noticed that there haven't been very many updates on Kansas Cyclists, that's why. But don't worry, things will pick up again at some point, I guess. I do have one item I'd like to discuss, and that is the Can Bike Walk annual meeting that I attended in Wichita on October 31st. Can Bike Walk, as you may or may not know, is a statewide nonprofit organization that advocates for bicyclists and pedestrians. Numbers are a little bit hard to pin down, but estimates I've seen say that at least 25% of people ride bicycles, at least occasionally, and of course nearly everyone is a pedestrian. But somehow there's never been a unified voice for all these people in Kansas, and that's what Can Bike Walk is trying to become. On the podcast in the past, we've talked with Can Bike Walk board members, including President Gina Portner, Vice President Dale Crawford, and Membership Chairman Mark Rainey. I think this organization is really important for the state, and that's why I volunteer as the webmaster for the group. The meeting itself was preceded by a leisurely ride along the Arkansas River on some of Wichita's fine bike paths, and I'll talk a bit more about those later during the trail segment. There wasn't a huge turnout for the ride, but nine of us braved the chilly morning temperatures, and by the time we finished the short ride, it had warmed up quite nicely and turned into a really beautiful day. I want to thank Robert Garcia, who runs a Wichita cycling blog called River City Cyclist at rivercitycyclist.com, for helping me put together the ride for Can Bike Walk. I'm not that familiar with Wichita, so his local knowledge was critical in picking out a safe and a scenic route. Robert also helped a great deal in publicizing the event, and most of the local riders we pulled in were due to his efforts. One of the reasons I was excited about holding the meeting in Wichita was that I think the bicycling scene there is really growing, with a lot of new people getting into bikes, both for recreation and for transportation. Of course, the Oz Bicycle Club, which has over 250 members and has been around since the early 70s, is a big part of that, particularly on the recreational side, but sites such as River City Cyclist and smaller groups like the Kansas Single Track Society and the Coasters Bicycle Club are really helping to turn Wichita into a cycling community. Okay, on to the meeting. The first segment was a review of Can Bike Walk's accomplishments during the year, which included presentations to the Kansas Drivers Education Instructors Conference and the Traffic Safety Conference, speaking at transportation meetings across the state, and Can Bike Walk's first Advocacy Day, in which a number of us journeyed to the state capitol in Topeka to introduce ourselves to state lawmakers. That was followed by a roundtable discussion of bike ped issues in Kansas, which helped to set some of the goals for the coming year, which include a focus on participating in the Kansas Department of Transportation's T-Link meetings, which will continue to map out future transportation funding for the state, and the opening of conversations with key state legislatures about upcoming Kansas about updating the Kansas bicycling laws, especially in regards to the very important subject of inattentive driving. Can Bike Walk will again hold an advocacy day, probably in February or March, and I'll get you the info on that as it becomes available.
And Randy, thanks so much for your work as webmaster. I know that's a volunteer effort, and it's a great website for people. What is the address for the listeners?
Canbikewalk.com.
Right. So do get over there. To keep up with the latest bicycling news from Kansas and neighboring states, please subscribe to the Kansas Cycling News at the Kansas Cyclist website. You can subscribe both using an RSS feed reader or via email. And for even more timely news, follow Kansas Cyclist on Twitter at twitter.com/KansasCyclist or on Facebook at facebook.com/KansasCyclist. And to keep up with just the podcast, follow us at twitter.com/KSBikePodcast and on facebook.com/KSBikePodcast.
And one other note on Can Bike Walk, you can find them on Twitter at Can Bike Walk and on Facebook at Can Bike Walk as well. And on the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, we've also added something new, which is a listener feedback line. You can now call 913-938-6855 to leave us a voice message. And if you'd like for us to get back in contact with you, be sure to leave your name and number.
Okay, on to upcoming rides. There's many rides that you have detailed on the website. What do you have of interest for us in this episode?
Well, there's not too many to choose from this time of year. Cyclocross season is still going on and will through February, but today I want to focus on Coronado's Challenge, a two-day mountain bike event that takes place at Coronado Heights, which is near Lindsberg, Kansas. Coronado Heights is a large hill that offers a panoramic view of the surrounding plains and is reputed to be the place where Francisco Coronado abandoned his search for the Seven Cities of Gold and turned around to return to Mexico in 1541. This is the seventh year for the event, which includes a downhill race, a hill climb event, and a four-hour cross-country race.
Very interesting history there.
Yeah, it sounds like a cool place. I want to visit there. The other event I'd like to talk about, which is actually a series of events, is known as Cranksgiving, a melding of bicycles and Thanksgiving. Cranksgiving events are often set up as alley cat races, where participants race from place to place, gather food items, and then return them to a central location. The first one to gather and return all the items on the list wins the race. Cranksgiving events are usually somewhat loosely organized and are held in many of the major cities in the region. Omaha and St. Louis had their events last weekend, and Kansas City and Des Moines are set to go this coming weekend. Kansas City's event is supposed to take place on November 22nd at 2 p.m. from the Discovery Center at 47th and Troost. There may be more around the Midwest, and if you're curious, I'd say to just check with your local bike shop to see if one is scheduled for your town. As I said, they're kind of unofficial and off the air, so off the map type of events, but if anyone's in the know, it's going to be your local bike shop.
And remember, for a complete listing of rides and races, visit the events section of the Kansas Cyclist website. These listings will have more details on how to sign up for the events, with both registration links and links back to the actual rides. We wanted to spend just a moment and talk about Action Wipes, one of our sponsors, and in fact our first sponsor. Action Wipes are made specifically for athletes using 100% natural ingredients, including pure oils such as tea tree and eucalyptus. And take it from our experience, they really do work. So stop using baby wipes with all that alcohol that can and does dry out your skin with repeated use, and try Action Wipes. For more information, go to the Kansas Cyclist website and you will see the ad with a link to order. All Kansas Cyclist podcast listeners get 15% off their orders by using the website link or by just entering Kansas on their orders. In accordance with the new FTC regulations, the Kansas Cyclist is not provided free Action Wipes and receives remuneration only through the sales on the website. Action Wipes now also has a Facebook page, so if you like their product, do become a fan. Okay, now it's time for new trails to try. Like so many other pieces of information, Randy has links to almost all the riding trails in Kansas and adjoining states on the website. Is there a trail that you would like to detail for our listeners in this episode?
Well, this time out, I'd like to share a ride report from the Wichita Bike Pass. The ones I rode are known, I think, as the Arkansas River Path and the Zoo Path. The former runs from downtown Wichita along the Arkansas River northwest to where it connects up to the Sedgwick County Zoo and the Sedgwick County Park. I didn't ride the entire length of either trail, but only about a total of 16 miles. But they really were, for the most part, nice, particularly the river trail, which runs right along the river. And in many places, there are paths on both sides of the river with numerous pedestrian bridges, as well as side paths along the major vehicular bridges. It was really very scenic along the Arkansas. And the best part of the route was the Keeper of the Plains, which is a 44-foot-tall steel sculpture of an Indian warrior situated at the place where the Big Arkansas and the Little Arkansas rivers meet. This is a very impressive piece of art, as are the two pedestrian bridges that span the rivers and meet in the middle. Wichita has something like 26 miles of multi-use paths, as well as over 100 miles of on-street bicycle routes. I didn't get the chance to explore as much as I like, so I hope to go back. But in my brief tour, I was really pretty impressed.
And this was, as you said earlier, part of the Can Bike Walk.
Yeah.
And you had, I know, posted some of those pictures on your Facebook page. That did look very nice.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Well, as always, Randy has several, if not all, the trails in Kansas and surrounding states on the website. So if you see one that's not listed, I'm sure he would like to know. And we'll certainly put that up on the website. We would like to introduce the co-owner of our new sponsor, Grease Monkey Wipes, who is Tim Stansberry, or as some call him, the Grease Monkey Man. After receiving a marketing degree and an MBA at Oklahoma State University, Tim held a variety of jobs, including retail manager and a change coordinator for a manufacturing firm. As the telecommunications marketplace began to heat up, Tim joined a small consulting firm as a research analyst. This position led him being hired by a $100 billion telecom company. He spent over 7 years serving as a product manager and a product marketing consultant for this company. When Grease Monkey Wipes was initially formed, Tim had a full-time job and devoted evenings and weekends to the company. However, since the beginning of 2009, Tim has been working full-time on Grease Monkey Wipes. What Grease Monkey Wipes are is individually wrapped, degreasing cleaning wipes that utilize a natural, non-toxic citrus formula to handle heavy-duty cleaning, including bike, grease, and road grime associated with a mid-ride repair. Due to the portable nature of the product, Grease Monkey Wipes usually easily fit in a saddlebag, jersey pocket, or a small box. The durable nature of the wipes allows them to easily clean not only skin, but also an oily chain, a dirty frame, and more. Tim began his riding career after watching Lance Armstrong in the Tour de France in 2004. Lance's struggle inspired Tim to take up cycling and led him to ride in several charity cycling events, including the American Diabetes Association Tour de Cure, the National Multiple Sclerosis Society MS-150, and the Lance Armstrong Foundation Livestrong Challenge. Tim routinely participates in several charity events each year and just recently completed a 24-hour event that supported the Lance Armstrong Foundation. When not participating in a charity event, Tim can be regularly spotted on a local weekend ride or hanging at a bike shop. The other co-owner of Grease Monkey Wipes is Aaron Whalen, who works in marketing and co-developed the product with Tim. Tim lives in Austin, Texas with his wife, Carrie, and their black lab, Wiley. Welcome to the podcast, Tim, and thanks for being a sponsor of the Kansas Cyclist Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. I'm really happy to be able to talk to you guys today, and I'm really proud to be a sponsor of this podcast.
I wanted to let you know that I actually started using Grease Monkey Wipes earlier this year and really liked them. And I do like the fact that they're individually wrapped, because I've taken them not only on my bike, but I have some in my car and even in my briefcase. So it's a great product. How did you come up with the idea for this?
Yeah, originally Aaron and myself, Aaron's the co-owner with me, we were on a century ride in the summer of 2007, and she got a flat about 15 miles in. She was pretty persistent on wanting to change the flat herself, so she did. But, you know, she hadn't been doing it for a while, so her hands got really greasy. She had also just happened to buy a new kit. It was a lighter color. So she didn't want to just wipe her hands on her shorts like she normally would. You know, the middle of summer in Texas, a lot of dead grass. It didn't seem to take off the grease very well, and actually more stuck to her hands than anything else. So, you know, she fixed the flat, rode on, and we just discussed, you know, there's nothing out there where you can just clean up your hands in a really portable fashion. Once we got back to Austin after the ride, you know, we continued to talk about it and did some research and couldn't find any products like that, so we decided to create our own. So what we did is we did a lot of research online, tried to find the best cleaning solution for your hands that wouldn't be a harsh chemical, and lo and behold, we came up with our product, Grease Monkey Wipes.
Tim, on your product, is it a proprietary formula, or how did you come up with the formula?
We came up with the formula by working with our manufacturer. We went back and forth with several iterations, and every time they would send us a compound, we would test it out and rank it on five or six different variables, including smell, how well it cleaned, the hand feel, and also sort of the residue that it would leave on your hands after the product. After doing that for about 3 to 4 months and really working with them, not only on that on the solution side, but also the wipe creation and the composition of the wipe, we came up with the product that we carry today. We're really proud of it, and you think it has a lot of great benefit for not only the cleaning, but, you know, the residue doesn't stay on your hands very long, but it does do a great job at getting off some grease and grime and, you know, some pretty nasty stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you get the wipes to take off the grease without using any harsh chemicals?
We use a natural citrus-based formula. Actually, it is a formula that is sustainable because it used to be a waste product. So when they squeeze oranges for orange juice, the citrus oil that comes out, they used to just throw it away. And then they realized that it was a good natural cleaning agent. So that's the main cleaning agent, and, you know, for our wipe, and that's what we use.
And it's safe for all types of skin, or just your hands, or can you use it on your face?
You could use it on your face. I personally probably wouldn't use it on, you know, like your forehead, if then you're going to sweat, because your sweat's going to pick up maybe some of those citrus oils, and if those got in your eyes, it'd probably sting a little. Yeah. But, you know, it'd be no worse than, for example, if you're peeling an orange and some of the oil kind of shoots you in the eye. So, you know, it might sting a bit, but it's certainly not anything that's going to be toxic or have any long-term effect.
And where's your business located?
We're located out of Austin, Texas. Both myself and Aaron, we live down here. Also, it provides us a great sort of proving ground because we can cycle down here probably, I'd say, 9 to 10 months out of the year. And it's really a hotbed, obviously, during the summer with not only cyclists but triathletes. So it, you know, it lets us test out the product, it lets us get to a lot of events, get some firsthand customer feedback, and things of that nature.
Is that what you do? Do you go to a lot of the events and put out samples so people can try them out?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had the product now for only a little over a year. And when we first got the product last summer, we would attend many things and just hand out the product, give them to people, sort of get their feedback. More this year, we've been attending triathlon expos and being involved in finish line carnivals. And we've had a lot of success more selling the product on that side. But then we also do have a great opportunity if, you know, we want to think of other alternatives for the wipe or other uses, or, you know, just to get feedback from customers. It's a great way to be right there in front of the customer, see what they like, see what they don't like, and, you know, think about new products and future directions for our company.
So how much of your sales are coming from those events versus on the web? I mean, how are you marketing yourself?
We use a combination of the events, like you mentioned. And we also do social media, obviously, the Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, not so much anymore. But, you know, that was when we began about a year and a half ago. That was still had a very large presence. But just getting there, out there in front of the customers, trying to do some press releases, doing things like this, podcasts, getting on cycling blogs to have them review the product. Really, for lack of a better term, you know, all the free ways to get your product out there and in front of people.
Mm-hmm. Do you do some paid advertising too?
To this point, no, not at all. Mm-hmm. We're still such a new and young company, and so many people don't know about us that all the money that we currently have and have into it, you know, they go to the weekly expenses, the daily expenses, figuring out events to attend, etc.
Are you kind of marketing exclusively to cyclists, or are you trying to hit any other markets?
At this point, we're really looking at cyclists and triathletes just because those are the market spaces that both Aaron and myself know. Also, it's, as I said, you know, Austin is such a hotbed that there's probably 25 local shops, you know, and we can go in and talk to the owners there. And since they are individual shops and we can go in and speak to them, it's much easier to demonstrate the product, get it in front of them, etc. Now, once you get into other markets, which we do hope to move into, which would be, you know, for example, automotive, the do-it-yourself type shops, those have much more stringent buying requirements, national buying requirements, many times, you know, 20, 30-page documents that need to be filled out. And, you know, we're just not at that stage yet, just based on the cycles that we have to dedicate to this and all the things that we have to do as small business owners.
Are you in, how many bike shops have the product now?
Right now, approximately 40.
Wow.
We're hoping to obviously expand out of that. We have hopefully a large deal the first of the year that will just bring us up to about 120 just in that one particular deal. And then we're always out looking for other retailers that are interested in the product, whether that's contacting them directly through, you know, sending them some samples, you know, trying to DM them on Twitter after, you know, we begin a relationship there, becoming Facebook friends, you know, just really looking for a wide variety of ways just to connect with the shop owner or the decision maker.
You talked about the uses of social media. What percent of your sales do you think you're getting from that? Has that been successful for you?
For the financial outlay, obviously, because, you know, all you have to do in our instance is, you know, you be part of the conversation on Twitter. More and more people pick you up on there. We have discount codes associated with Twitter. And we really try to track every discount code that we have out there. And I would say, you know, not a huge majority of people come through from Twitter or something, but it's, you know, sometimes it's harder to track if maybe they saw something on Twitter, but then 2 weeks later go to your website and purchase, and you know, maybe they don't remember to put in the discount code.
Right.
I'd say from other social media avenues, for example, some blogs we've been in, I think we have a much greater uptick in sales from those, just because of the fact that, you know, in a sense, those are unbiased third-party reviews of our product. So I think those add more weight to the customer coming forward if they see that, you know, another blog, even though they might receive the wipes for free, they've tested them out, maybe they've taken some pictures, you know, they can get a sense and feel of the wipe without having them in their hands. Whereas most people obviously realize that Twitter is, in a way, our own propaganda out there in the marketplace.
I was on your Facebook page, and it looks really nice. When did you put that up?
We've been doing Facebook and, you know, Twitter now for pretty much the whole time we've had the product, so for almost a year. And as, you know, as things propagate, obviously we learn new things. Like, for example, our Twitter background used to just be very basic. But then as more and more utilities come out there for the do-it-yourselfer to figure out, you know, the backgrounds and everything, you know, we jazz those up and try to incorporate look and feel of our website, some product pictures, some, you know, fun pictures that we might have in there. And the same thing with Facebook, you know, as that's grown and as it's changed, you know, we try to keep up with the sort of the trends and being able to give our customers or our fans, you know, sort of a fresh look all the time.
Well, I wanted to let our listeners know that by entering Kansas as the coupon code, they will receive a 15% discount, and there'll be a direct link on the Kansas Cyclist website and also in the show notes so that people can get there. And as with all our other disclosures, and in accordance with the new FTC regulations, the Kansas Cyclist is not provided free grease monkey wipes and receives numeration only through the sales on the website. Well, Tim, thanks so much for being on the show, and the best of luck. This is really a great product, and as I said, I've used it, and that's why we, you know, were interested in working with you. One of the things I did notice on the Facebook page is you have some great bike jerseys. Are those available, or are those just for you guys in selling?
Yeah, absolutely. We have all the products that we have either on Facebook or Twitter that either we talk about or have images of are available on our website at greasemonkeywipes.com. Not only do we have the wipes, but we also do have T-shirts, hats, those cycling jerseys, like you mentioned, cycling gloves. And in the future, we hope to even expand to have a little bit more, have a full kit, you know, bib shorts, sleeve warmers, et cetera, as we move forward. So, yeah, you know, just starting out with one product and then, you know, try to work and get that brand out there to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
My pleasure. I appreciate you guys taking the time to speak with me today.
Randy, has there been any feedback that you would like to share from our listeners in this episode?
We've had a couple of listeners contact us. One expressed satisfaction with the sound quality in the last episode, which was good for us to hear, as that was one thing we've been experimenting with. Another listener, who I met at the Kanbach Walk meetings, said he was a regular listener and enjoyed the podcast and found it useful, but he noted that we focused a bit too much on people and events in eastern Kansas. Well, I guess we're guilty as charged. With both Ed and I living in the Kansas City area and most of the cyclists we know hailing from here as well, I guess that's only natural. But we are sensitive to the problem and we want to expand our focus. When I set up the website, I didn't call it Kansas City Cyclist, I called it Kansas Cyclist. And I did that because I wanted to cover the whole state and beyond. So it'll happen, but be patient. And you can help by forwarding us contact information for people who you'd like to hear on the show. We'll get a hold of them and get the ball rolling.
Yes, and really from the beginning, we've wanted to cover the entire region, and you'll see in today's interview with Kim West from Des Moines, we have, I think, is a good example of us trying to expand out our focus and our audience beyond just here in Kansas. Remember that you can contact us by email at podcast@kansascyclist.com and now via our new phone number at 913-938-6855. And you can also comment on the news blog and on our Facebook page or via Twitter. Hey, do you organize a ride or know someone that does? Well, we have the perfect solution for you, and it is called VeloCal. VeloCal.org is a slick, web-based bicycle calendar that is extremely easy to set up and use compared to other web-based group calendars. So give it a try, as VeloCal is built for and by cyclists, and best of all, it is free. As many of you know, I organize a ride on Saturday mornings called the Quivira Park Bike Ride, from May through October here in the Kansas City area. What I like most about VeloCal is that when I have to change the ride, such as for rain, the service will send out a new email to all subscribed riders of that change. It is a great program, so please click on the link on the Kansas Cyclist website and start using this calendar, which is based out of Fort Collins, Colorado. In accordance with the new FTC regulations, the Kansas Cyclist does not receive any remuneration from VeloCal, and instead we both promote each other's services through cross-marketing of each other's websites. Continuing a feature of our podcast, which we call Bicycle Safety Tips, we are detailing information from bicyclesafe.com and going over their 10 tips on how not to get hit by cars. The discussion today is tip 7, the right hook, part 2. What the right hook part 2 is when you're passing a slow-moving car or even another bike on the right when it unexpectedly makes a right turn right into you, trying to get to a parking lot, driveway, or a side street. Randy, how do we avoid this type of collision?
We've talked about this before, but I guess it bears repeating. Don't pass on the right. Even if you're in a bike lane and there's a car stopped or slowed in the main traffic lane, don't pass on the right. Drivers simply don't expect to be passed on the right, and they may make sudden right turns without even looking. The other problem with passing on the right is that the car may be stopped to let someone out. The passenger door may open suddenly right into your path, and this is especially a problem with children, as they're often too short to see over the seat back, so you have no idea they're in there. So just avoid the temptation to pass on the right. But if you must pass, do so properly by passing on the left. Yeah, you'll need to move further into the main traffic lane, or perhaps even the opposite lane to do this, but it's still safer than passing on the right. Just be sure to look back and signal your intentions before changing lanes. Now, there's a special case here when you're passing a slow-moving cyclist. Again, it's better to pass on the left, but if they're riding too far into the lane for you to pass and showing no willingness to budge, then call out on your right and carefully pass them. And finally, there's a corollary to the don't pass on the right rule, and that is look behind you before turning right. After all, another cyclist may not be following the rules and trying to sneak by you on your right. You just never know.
And the other thing that bears repeating is that a lot of times our mirrors are on the left side, so we don't see a cyclist on the right. So even more important to shout out. And those that, if you don't have a mirror, you know, get one. We've talked about that in the past,
right,
too. In the next podcast, we will be talking about tip 8 called the left cross. And again, all these tips can be found at bicyclesafe.com. Today we will be interviewing Kim West, the host of the Kim West Radio Hour on KXNO 1460 from Des Moines, Iowa. Kim tells us that he was born in the President Eisenhower era and considers himself a child of the space race and black and white television that included shows such as Captain Kangaroo, Howdy Doody, The Mickey Mouse Club, Sky King, Roy Rogers, The Lone Rangers, and much more. He has been politically active since the mid-1960s and naturally tended towards hippie-yippie ideologies. He graduated from the University of Iowa with a B.S. in elementary education in 1978 and a law degree in 1982. Kim was a single parent and during that time ran a daycare center, drove a campus bus for the University of Iowa, and a city bus for Iowa City. He also founded what he calls The Orphanage in 1983 to help homeless bike racers in the Des Moines area. He quit his full-time job with the state to play in and tour with a band in 2002, then worked in a coffee shop for 3 years. Tim helped start the Des Moines Bike Collective and began the Kim West Radio Hour in April of 2008. Kim started riding bicycles in 1955 with a little fixer gear bike with 8-inch solid rubber tires. He first did Ragbri in 1974 and has done several over the years since then. Kim began racing bikes in 1983 while living in Mason City, Iowa, and is now a Cat 1 racer at the age of 57. He has raced in road, criterions, time trials, cyclocross, mountain bike, tandem, gravel, BMX, and cross-country skiing events, which have included wins in every discipline except BMX. Kim is the current Midwest Marathon Gravel Road Race Grandmaster Champion. In 2010, he is hoping to do the Leadville race and resume tandem racing, in addition to the usual road, gravel, and cyclocross. He has been seen heckling racers at the annual Snake Alley Criterion since the early 1990s. Kim lives in Des Moines, Iowa, with his three Russian wolfhounds. Welcome, Kim, and thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. This is a treat for me to be the talker rather than the talkie.
Yeah, it would be fun to interview you and see how you do from that side. It was a great show 2 weeks ago with Tyler Hamilton. I've subscribed to your podcast, so it was a real good interview.
Thanks. I've been working to get Tyler for some time, and it's good, and it's he assures me the first of several. I'd like to get him in on a regular basis doing fitness and training consulting too. But Tyler's a real cool person to talk to, and he's a good interview.
Yeah, it sounded that way from the interview. Well, tell us a little bit about how the Kim West Radio Hour got started.
I do weddings, right? I'm a minister, and I've done them for about 6 years or so, a little over 6 years. And I did a wedding for some friends of mine and went out to the reception afterwards. Another friend of mine came in and said, "Hey, Kim, I think I've got a..." And at the time, this guy was a sales rep for the local sports station, KXNO. In town, he said he thought he had the program manager convinced to let him have an hour on Sunday nights to do a radio show. And we chit-chatted a little bit, and he suggested one person as a host. I said, "Dude, I can do a better job than that," and that's how I got it. So it's all been kind of fortuitous, and that was about 3 or 4 months before it got started. It would have been, I think, in January of 2008, and we started April 20th of last year, and we had, 82 episodes so far, it's really interesting because I didn't know anything about radio other than an on-off switch and AM and FM. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting there in front of the same microphones that, allegedly Ronald Reagan and other people, Jim Zobel and all sorts of other, real radio titans. And then here's some schmo that rides bikes in there. So pretty interesting.
Yeah, so you actually go into the studio to do the recording.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We're in the and it's interesting because KXNO is a ball sports station, baseball, football, basketball, and that's about it. And everything else they make fun of. Bicycling especially, they don't like that stuff. And so it's probably good I'm there on a Sunday night when not many other folks are around. But I pop up, during the week and do stuff. And whether they know me or not, I don't know, but they see somebody walking around in cycling stuff, they must figure it's me.
And has it always been a weekly broadcast?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sunday nights is kind of a throwaway night for them, and for cyclists it's good because, you know, they're you know, usually on their way home from a race or they're down for the count or whatever, and but it also works out well that you know, it's available for podcasts and it goes up Sunday night and the Monday morning web activity for my show is the busiest of all five channels that they have here in town. So that's kind of nice to know. And those are kind of impressive numbers. They kind of started out doubting Thomas's, but they can understand, you know, traffic on the website.
Kim, do you have information on the rating or number of listeners of the broadcast, and then also maybe separate numbers for the podcast?
The way they do that, Nielsen people, is that the weekend shows, they just sort of throw them all together. They can give you breakdowns for certain time slots during the week, Monday through Friday, but the Saturdays and Sundays, no, they don't break it up like that. It's my understanding that numbers are available for podcast activity. I don't have the specific numbers, but I know that it comes out with ratings like monthly hits and weekly hits and so forth, and we are pretty consistently right in the top five for website activity on during any given month, which just floors me. For actual traffic on the podcast and website stuff, I don't have that. I know there's a guy at the station who keeps track of all that stuff, but you know, it's just like it doesn't matter to me. I know that we have listeners all over the world, and that amazes me too. We've got some regular listeners in England and Australia and New Zealand. It's like, good Lord, it's great. It's gratifying. I get emails from listeners all over the country, you know, I try to do shows where I involve people in different parts of the country. Like somebody sent me a link about this pretty interesting ride in Portland, and I've got friends who live out in Portland and listeners who live out in Portland, but I'm going to do a show about that particular ride. And it's just a way of getting, you know, people across the country involved in my show. So they realize, okay, well, that's a show about us. It's also a show about other stuff that's interesting. So it's still a real small thing.
Yeah, but KXNO then must really, I mean, they must be pleased because they've still got you on. And you've got advertisers on the show too, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I just think, I mean, realistically, I think the numbers that we generate in terms of revenue at this point anyway, compared to what the other shows generate, is pretty minuscule, I think. I mean, I get treated like that, so it must be true. You know, I don't have a regular automobile sponsor, for example. You know, I don't have any shop at this point that's giving me a bike to ride just to make them feel good. But I'm working on it. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know how much work it takes to put together a podcast every couple of weeks. What's it take to do a radio show weekly?
Dave Cornelison is the guy behind the scenes for me, and he actually doesn't work at the station anymore, but he worked there for maybe 7 or 8 years doing advertising sales. And apparently the rule of thumb is, you know, 3 hours for every hour on the show. And boy, you know, I spend sometimes an hour or two just during the week contacting people and lining things up and answering emails and updating, you know, websites, Facebook, stuff like that. And then doing the reading and research that I do to try to, you know, finagle this host on or that host on. And that's just, you know, the day of the show, I get down there to the station, you know, maybe 4:30, something like that, and do some of the final prep work on. And then right as soon as the show's over at 7, I run in to the other studio and edit the podcast and put it up. And I'm getting better at it. It used to take me an hour, hour and a half to edit, you know, a 60-minute show. You know, because I go through and try to equalize the sound and all that kind of stuff. And we've got certain sponsors that are just for the radio show and certain shows that are for the, or certain sponsors that are for the podcast. And we do that kind of stuff. But you know, I'm getting better at it and just learning Adobe and these various, you know, little software things makes a heck of a difference. But then when I go to big races like the Tour of Missouri, for example, or coming up to Jingle Cross and stuff like that, I've got a lot of people that I want to talk to ahead of time. And so that's just, that's really a full-time gig, and I'm not getting a penny out of it, you know, but I do it because I love it. So that's how that works. So it's just like most of the things I do, they're labors of love, which is good.
Well, tell us about the start of the bike collective.
Oh, the bike collective. That's another labor of love. The bike collective is what's known in many towns or states as bike co-ops or bike libraries or whatever. It's a nonprofit place where basically you accept donated bikes and volunteer labor and material, and you turn out good rideable bikes that you either give away or sell very cheaply. That's the principle and the premise of it. Here in Des Moines, I had been wanting to do something like this for a long, long time. A friend of mine down in Iowa City was one of the people that got the bike library going down there. And in Iowa City, it's a great going concern, and it's a legitimate presence on the bike scene in town there. So we tried to do something like that in Des Moines. I'm just a guy with a lot of ideas and connections, but I'm not really the kind of person that's got the access and the open door invitations to the people that are the powers that be. But I was down at my favorite coffee shop, one morning, probably 2006, because I had just recovered, I'd just gotten out of the hospital with a collapsed lung from a bike crash, and I was sitting there drinking coffee and ran into a couple of guys that I know that were getting together to have a meeting for the same thing. And so we got in on it, the three of us did, and we pounded the pavement for about a year and a half before we were able to get a space available. But that meant we had to work through the political ends of it and the financial ends of it and the community organizing ends of it and the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts. But we've got a space that's donated space for us. We've got our 501c3 nonprofit status, and we've got volunteers lined up and programs that we're building and access to schools and programs going on in schools. And for me, the bike collective is a place where basically the bottom line is you want to put, butts on bikes. There's people out there that don't have bikes that want them and need them and don't know how to go about getting them. And we've got a lot of people in the community who want to learn more about fixing bikes and more about, just recycling in the ultimate sort of way where you actually reuse. It's also becoming a community resource center. I'm a former school teacher, and I've got a keen interest in working with kids and getting kids on bikes, because I think there's just going to be a lost generation of Americans that are never going to understand what bicycling is all about. But if you start out with little kids, then you get them into it, and then I think that's a way to raise a generation of people who actually know what cycling is all about and what it can be. So we're doing that, and by setting up the collective in such a way, we are working with the Boys and Girls Club, we're working with the school district, we're working with the Variety Club and other organizations, specific schools and specific programs, not just in the Des Moines area proper, but also outlying areas as well, too, in setting up safe routes to school, Bike to Work Week, which is expanded next year for Bike to Work Month, and we're setting up cycling clubs in some of these schools. One of my little pet projects is to have a cycling team, a cycling league in Des Moines, and so we're working with the schools to get that. What I hope to do, which would be something that would help generate regular income and fund the collective and all of our programs, is to generate interest and support to build a velodrome, which would be the place, the ultimate safe place where we can teach kids how to ride bikes, not only kids, but adults and everything, learn their bike handling skills in a completely safe, enclosed, off-street sort of way, so they have the confidence and the skills and the abilities to go out on the streets and not get run over, and just be good, safe cyclists, but also have it be a sort of, thing in the community that people would see and identify as, oh, that's cycling, so that the non-cycling public can see it and realize, oh, this is pretty cool stuff, so we've got locations, a couple of locations that the city has offered and said, we can make this space available for you that would make it be a very visible part of the community, because they understand what a key economic piece it could be in the vitality of the community. So I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff. For me, it's just a matter of making the connections and having people go, oh, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't want to actually have to do all the work, though.
Well, I try to monitor the bicycling news from Iowa, and I know that earlier this year you had the bicycle safety bill that came up in the legislature and failed. This summer, you seem like you've had an awful lot of cyclists being injured and killed, and you had that petition and just all kinds of hostility. Is there blowback from that failed bill?
Here, frankly, if people want to blame me or give me credit for helping to kill the bill, I'm happy with that, because, frankly, I think that the proposal they put forth is a horrible, horrible thing to do, and it's not at all the right way to go about it. And I realize that I ruffle feathers of a lot of bicyclists and make gleeful a lot of the motorists, but they need to stop and listen to what I'm saying. When people ride bikes, there's several kinds of riders, but the kind that most motorists encounter are one of two kinds. There's ones who, you know, ride at the side of the road and yield the whole lane, and there's the kind that ride down the middle of the lane and occupy the lane and own the lane because it's theirs. I'm in that group, and I think that's the way to be. You have to make yourself seen and seen as someone who is riding in such a way that you tell everybody just by your positioning that I'm here and you got to deal with me, right? The people who have been over the years, this is a gross generalization, but it's you know, just enough fact combined with my gut feeling on these things in talking with, you know, individuals who are riding with them or have ridden with them in the past and so forth. These folks have had a tendency to ride over on the white line, and so a motorist encounters them and doesn't know what to do, and so they think, well, I don't need to give them very much space, right? And then so therefore they're likely to get clipped and nicked and run over and killed, and I don't think that's the way to do it. And so the idea of a bicycle bill of rights that says, okay, you've got 3 feet or 5 feet when people pass you, that's, to me, that's a surrender position, because right now we've got the whole lane. We've got a 10-foot or a 12-foot wide lane. And then for us to go up and say, hey, we demand 3 to 5 feet, well, that's like saying, you know, paint a yellow stripe up our backs, you know. I'm not willing to do that. I read the Code of Iowa to say that we have every right to that entire lane. And I don't care what we do in it, you know. It's our lane. If you want to pass, pass on the left. You know? So I'm happy it failed, frankly. But there is a lot of negative response to both positions. Cyclists aren't happy with me, and motorists aren't happy with me. But I'm alive, you know, knock wood. And that's how I teach kids to ride bikes. When I'm going out to schools, I say you have to be not afraid of traffic. You have to be certain of your skills and abilities. You have to be aware of where you are and who's around you and this kind of stuff. And don't get into situations where you really can't do both of those things.
So, and you don't differentiate between a two-lane road or a four-lane road. So, I mean, you would still take the lane, the full lane, on a two-lane road.
Whatever lane I'm not stupid, right? There are certain roads that I just avoid because the traffic is just too heavy, right? but as a rule, I'm not going to let time of day and traffic patterns dictate where I can and can't go if I'm riding a bicycle. I've been riding tandem lately too, you know, and the woman who's riding Stoker with me has been riding a long, long time, but she's been commenting, said, Kim, I can't believe how hostile and aggressive motorists are. And she knows and can bear witness to the fact that I'm not out there looking for trouble, you know, but I'm just riding the way people should ride. And people are just really angry. And every time the legislature brings up one of these harebrained ideas to give us a bill of rights, it really infuriates and mobilizes those people who don't like bicycles, like this idiot gun dealer from Van Meter who wants to ban bicycles altogether. Well, that's no good. You know, you're not going to do that. But my whole point is, we don't need new laws. We don't need more protections. We just need to have prosecutors and law enforcement people who will enforce fairly and evenly the laws that we currently have on the book. The laws we have on the book are absolutely fine. You know, an assault can be an assault, whether it's a gun or a hand or a motor vehicle. Excuse me. And they do that. They every now and then will charge someone with assault with a deadly weapon if it's an automobile and a pedestrian, for example, you know, but it as yet has not been used in Iowa involving someone with a car and a bicycle. You know, they get them with improper paths or things like that. Oh, that's just ridiculous. I mean, it's more than ridiculous. It's wrong, you know, and I have on the show from time to time started analogizing the way bicyclists are being treated as the way that the blacks were treated during the pre-civil rights days. You know, I mean, we are a harassed and endangered group. And I do that with all due respect to other groups that are being, you know, harassed and threatened. But, boy, you know, you want to talk about a hate crime, just look at cars and bicycles. You know?
So does that apply to your opinion on bike lanes, too? Do you see that as kind of segregation?
Well, I mean, maybe segregation, but I certainly see it as stupid. And I mean, there are some places where bike lanes work, right? But here, right now in Des Moines, there is a plan that has been approved to put bike lanes on Ingersoll Avenue. Well, Ingersoll Avenue is kind of a street that's near and dear to me because, you know, for a few years I worked at this coffee shop right on Ingersoll, and it's a shop that's owned and operated by a woman who commutes to work by bike. I mean, that's just how she gets around probably 70% of the time or more. And it's a very bicycle-friendly kind of place. And yet what they've done is taken the street from four-lane to two-lane with a dedicated middle turn lane from one end of Ingersoll at 18th Street to 42nd Street, and then bike lanes on either side of the single lane of traffic, and then parking on the outside. So the bicycles are like in a distasteful Oreo cookie. And I've studied Ingersoll because I ride my bike on Ingersoll, and I drive on Ingersoll, and I have since I moved to town in 1994. There is some bicycle traffic, and everything moves along just fine, right? But all of a sudden, it's like in Alaska, they built the bridge to nowhere. Well, these are the bike lanes to nowhere. You know, it's like all of a sudden traffic is supposed to get to one end or the other of Ingersoll Avenue and then flow happily downhill or uphill in these silly little bike lanes, you know, and then that's it. And then where do you go? Well, you get dumped out on the west end on Martin Luther King / Fluor Drive, which is a monstrosity, and then you get dumped out into the city, and there's no – so it's not well thought out at all, you know, you know, I mean, there's another bike lane on Cottage Grove in town, which goes from the Drake area across the freeway and dumps you out in just short of another residential neighborhood. Well, big deal. There's not an outcry for bike lanes there either. You know, so, I mean, I like the idea. I like the idea that the city is attempting to do something, but the people who are whispering in the ears of the city fathers and mothers don't know what they're talking about. And I know the people who are doing the whispering. God love them. Their hearts are in the right places, but their heads are up their butts, you know? That's how I call it.
Well, let's talk about some of the specific incidents. I believe there was a sheriff's deputy that was hit this summer.
Yeah. She was the second major incident. And she lived, I don't know whether it was in Ankeny or near Ankeny, and she was commuting on a regular basis. She was the chief jailer, and they moved the jail from downtown out to the northeast side of town. And so she had basically a rural ride to work every morning. And I know the route, and I know the ride. Although I don't know the deputy personally, I've spoken with a number of people who know her. She just got into cycling a year or two ahead beforehand, but she had all sorts of red lights, all sorts of blinkies all around her, and the motorist said that he didn't see her. Well, no, that's just a flat-out lie. You know, you can maybe say I didn't notice her or I wasn't paying attention or something like that, but to say you didn't see her is just, if you didn't see that person, you shouldn't be driving, right? And fortunately there, the motorist stuck around and called immediately and all that kind of stuff. And the woman who was pretty seriously injured is okay and is going to be back at cycling, you know. But there was an incident shortly before that. It was the day before Easter, where my friend Doug Smith and some other folks were out on a training ride, and they leave from a bike shop on the west side of Des Moines and ride down to near Winterset and back. And it's maybe a 50-mile loop, and it's out on a nice diagonal, you know, county road, two-lane county road. And there's signs along the way that say share the road and all that kind of stuff. And they leave, as far as I'm concerned, way too early. But it's like 7:30 they leave. And so they were on their way back, and there were eight of them, and they were in a double pace line. They were just taking it easy on the way back. And Doug Smith, the kid who was struck, was at the front on towards the center of the double pace line, and they heard this steady honking, you know, and a cyclist knows a friendly honk from an angry honk, and this is a steady blasting of the horn for about 30 seconds as it came up from behind, and all of a sudden here's this truck pulling two anhydrous ammonia tanks, you know, and they never track smoothly, going up a slight rise in the road, and then he cut in too soon, and the duals of the trailer ran over Doug, and the guy kept going. You know, he hit his brakes, and they thought, well, maybe he's going to stop, but after they ran over Doug, the rear wheels bounced 18 inches in the air, right? Jeez. And so the guy hit the brakes just to stabilize the truck, and then kept going. Now, what kind of a cold, cruel, heartless creature does a thing like that? You can't even call him human, you know? I mean, it is absolutely inhuman to do that. You don't do that if you hit a deer, you know? And he kept going. And, you know, I mean, they stopped immediately, and one of the riders tried to, you know, chase him down. But you're not going to be able to catch, you know, somebody going 55 in a truck. But they were able to flag down an oncoming vehicle. It was a van driven by a guy who happens to be an area triathlete. He saw what was going on, stopped, turned around, and chased the guy down. Okay. Well, the guy continued on, dropped the trucks off, and then came back with somebody else 30 minutes after the accident. Okay. Well, that's just BS. There's absolutely no excuse for that at all. You park the truck at the side of the road and come back or whatever. I mean, leaving the scene is a crime in and of itself. But the fact that the guy was honking makes it clear to me that he saw him and knew what was going on, right? So that, in my mind, is an example where we have law enforcement that are cowards, and you have them backed up by prosecutors who are equally spineless creatures. And I have no sympathy or compassion for those people at all. Right? And then, insult to injury, another friend of mine, Mark Gergrich, is out on a Sunday morning out riding on that same road down in Madison County. And a guy came along, and as it unfolded, this guy was driving along, you know, 11:30 in the morning, you know, and it was a bright, maybe overcast day, but bright just the same. And Mark is another one of those riders that tended to ride to the side of the road. But Mark was 54 or something like that and been riding for years and years and years. And I guess this guy was trying to pass within the lane and met an oncoming car. Now, a lot of these vehicles apparently are only equipped with accelerators and not brakes, you know. And the idiots that drive them can't figure out that you can even let up on the accelerator, you know. But they pass in a no-passing zone, and rather than slow down or hit the brakes, he just pulled right over and broadsided Mark and, you know, knocked him into orbit, you know, and then drove off. Didn't even stop. He drove off and then got spray paint, covered it up, you know. You know, it's just... And the sad thing is, that's happened so many times to friends of mine, so many times, and nothing has happened. Nothing has happened. And you can get angry, and you can get angry. But for me, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I decided I'm going to start riding my bike to these funerals. And I started riding bikes. We organized when they were area, you know, cyclists, we would, you know, go in a group of 20 to 40 cyclists and go to the funeral, you know, get permission of the family, but then show up just to say, hey, you know, as cyclists, you know, he or she is a member of our family too, you know, and so we suffer, you know, your loss as well. And there were some, there were some lengthy rides, and so I'd have people ride with me, you know, as far as they could, and then I'd go and ride. And, you know, after a while, and I think there were like maybe six or seven funerals I went to that year. And that's just insane. I mean, that's just is absolutely insane. But it, you know, when you do that, and you've got 4, 5, 6 hours of riding each way to think about this stuff and think about why it is you ride bikes and what it means to you to be able to do that in some sort of relative safety, you know, and you think about the people that are affected by a death or an injury. You know, I went in Easter morning to visit Doug Smith in the hospital. You know, and there he is laying in bed, and he's all wrapped up and mangled and swollen and scraped, and his wife is there, and his young daughter is there, and his mother-in-law is there, you know, and he was able to get a little smile, and I said, well, Doug, I tell you, a lot better than bringing files, you know, you'll be out again, and he is, he's been attending races, he's been riding, some of his photographers, so he's taking pictures and stuff, but, you know, you see right there, I mean, it's Easter morning, and there's the immediate family who is not out, you know, hunting eggs and wearing bonnets and stuff like that. They're just sitting there at the hospital hoping daddy will live, you know. And the public doesn't care. The public at large doesn't care, or there would be an outcry, you know. It just, so those are the things I think about when I go on those funeral rides. And it, you know, and I mean, it leaves a mark, and that's good. It leaves me solemn and somber and dedicated, and it reinforces my feelings on it.
There was another question with the incident with Mark. The driver, wasn't he legally blind in one eye?
Yeah. He had a macular degenerative disease. Shouldn't have been driving in the first place, you know. And but you've got the community. You've got the community that sat on that for 2 weeks. People knew who it was. People knew who killed Mark, and they did nothing, you know. It's sick. It's sick. And you need to have somebody who has a lot more power, clout, and authority than me pick it up and say, hey, guys, you knock this crap off. You know, but we don't have anybody yet. And I decided after this last election cycle that I'm now a single-issue voter. And before I vote for anybody, I'm going to say, what are your thoughts on bicycles? Just ask some open-ended questions and see what they do. And if I don't like their answer, then they're not getting my vote. And I don't care what stripe they are. They're not going to get my support or my money. It's bad.
What were your thoughts on that California decision where the physician was convicted?
Oh, good for them. Good for them. I mean, who hasn't encountered a motorist like that, you know, and who taunts and torments and abuses? And this guy, you know, to suddenly say he was a doctor and he was just trying to save lives and but yet teach him a lesson, all that kind of stuff. I applaud the jury for doing that. But also getting back to the theme, I applaud the prosecutors and the law enforcement people for writing the tickets and prosecuting, because that's what we've got to do. You can't teach lessons if you give them $35 tickets for improper passing. You've got to throw the books at them. And I'm really bitter about the old man that killed Mark that committed suicide. Okay, how many acts of cowardice does it take? You know, it just people say, oh, he's a nice old man. But he killed Mark. You know, and then he didn't, you know, stand up and take his lumps. Sadly, an ironic twist, Terry Wright, this guy's attorney, is a friend of mine, and he died Sunday as well too. So it kind of closes the chapter on that one. But, you know, we've got friends and family of Mark now who won't get the closure from that at all. And we need somebody to do that. And I think it's important to hold elected officials accountable for that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, switching gears a little bit, Kim, with the Tour of Georgia not getting funding this year and having to cancel, and now the Tour of Missouri struggling to find a main sponsor, what do you think of the future of professional bicycle racing here in the United States?
Well, it's good. It's good. It's just unfortunate that right now we're going through this incredible economic, it's not even an upheaval, it's just a change of life. And I think people are going to realize that local entertainment is a good value. And Pete Kinder, the lieutenant governor in Missouri, will find sponsors for his race. I mean, that guy has been fighting for years to make it the success that it is, and I'm confident that someone will step up. Likewise, they're hopeful that somebody will step in and fund the tour of Georgia. I know it's hard, but people are still out there making money, and the fact that they're not traveling overseas to spend their vacation dollars, I think it's incumbent upon the state departments of economic development to showcase these events that are free and wholesome and just doggone good entertainment. So if they package it correctly, I think they'll see what a value they really are. The Tour of Missouri is a prime example of that this year. Just in Kansas City alone, I forget the dollars they were tossed around, but what Lieutenant Governor Kinder was saying, that for every dollar that they invested, they got $14 back. And if the state can't appreciate that kind of return on investment, they need to do something else, because clearly they're not state leaders. I've had the pleasure of getting to know a number of cyclists who are amateurs who are now professional riders, and they're riding for good major teams, and corporations are always stepping up, and because they understand the marketing scheme that will make their product look good, because it's associated with cycling, and I think, you know, it goes in cycles. I mean, cycling over 100 years ago was the sport. People like Major Taylor and other folks who were, you know, the kings of the world of cycling then, and then it just sort of, you know, as the automobile came along, it sort of became sort of a disused thing. But cycling in America didn't stop. And you saw a resurgence in the 70s and 80s, and again the whole Le Mans era and the Armstrong era. But it's happening, and there's more and more people all the time getting involved, and that's why I've been so happy to help out and help develop here in Des Moines. I helped start the BMX club and the BMX track, and we've got this beautiful track down on the southeast side of town that was just recently redesigned by the same man that designed the BMX track in the Beijing Olympics, right? I mean, so there's some serious interest in cycling. So we want to get kids on bikes on all levels so they will grow up understanding that it's it's not just the sport of kings, but it's the sport of everybody. And we've got to put some real effort into getting juniors involved, but we do have a small number of juniors, but we need to capitalize on that. And there's a kid who 14 years old, and he is an absolute terror on cyclocross, and he regularly wins the juniors cross races around, but he's also winning or finishing the top two in the category four races. And so he'll do two races and still be kicking butt. I'm going to have him as a guest on the show, because he has this great little entourage of little 14, 15-year-old kids who are now seeing, hey, cycling's pretty cool. And if I can help get him even more cachet, I think that's important, you know. But another thing that we're working on is getting more and more women involved. And I did a lot of racing around the country this year doing Masters championships, and saw the number of women 50 plus who, you know, they're riding balls out, and they're serious. They've got money and time to invest in cycling. And so one of the things I'm trying to do, we've got nice turnout. Actually, the turnouts for Category 4 women in Iowa is better than the turnout for the open Category 1, 2, 3 events. Now, as these Category 4 women gain experience and results, they'll be moving up, and so that'll take care of itself. But another thing that I'm going to be pushing for next year with all promoters is the introduction of a Masters women division, 45 plus, because we've got women who are 45, 50, 55 years old racing against teenagers and 20-year-olds. And then, you know, it's like, hey, come on, cut us a little slack here. You know, so by doing that, we'll give an even greater avenue for women who are doing triathlons and maybe thinking, well, you know, I kind of like this bike riding thing. And so as we get more and more regular people involved, I think they'll see that pro sports, pro cycling is really a very attractive and available asset for them to take advantage of. I mean, when I was down covering the Tour of Missouri, I was stunned at the number of people, not only from all over the country, but from Canada and Europe who had come just to see this event. And they were spending the week traveling across the state of Missouri. So I think it's good. I think it's just on a big scale. It looks like it's taken some hits, but when you step back and look at the number of pro teams in America and the number of pro cyclists in America, it's growing, both men and women. So it's just the headlines may, you know, have gloom and doom, but the story itself is a very positive story, and I'm really excited about it. Like I said, there's a lot of cyclists from Iowa who now have, you know, Matt Bush, Nick Fry, Tom Zirbel. Oh, my goodness. You know, and of course, the success story, as far as I'm concerned, a kid who started out as a junior, Jason McCartney, you know, who is now back in the Armstrong Brunel team after all these years. I mean, Jason started off as a little junior who would also, on Memorial Day weekend, do the juniors races, kick everybody. And this is back when they had strong, strong juniors events. And then he'd jump in the ones, twos, and kick everybody there. I mean, the Snake Alley Criterium is Jason's sport. I mean, that is his race, and you can't touch him. And Jason, after spending maybe two or three years away from the sport, came back. He's ridden with every top professional team in the world, you know, and that guy has an incredible story to tell. So,
do you think, Kim, that having these, you know, professional races, is that help highlight the sport and get younger folks involved in it, yeah, and then lead, yeah, to better, you know, professional racers that are from the U.S.?
It has. Mm-hmm. There's a friend of mine, Lowell Kellogg, an old teammate of mine, who's a school teacher in Wisconsin, but also the coach of the IS Corps juniors program, and he takes an incredibly good team of juniors up to Canada and all across the country to race. There are a number of really good junior teams, Hot Tubes the team from Missouri, I'm blanking on right now. But there are teams that have really, really good, strong junior programs, but individually there are outstanding kids. And there's a couple of kids here in Des Moines that I saw spending a couple of days down at the Tour of Missouri that their passion, you know, just exploded when they saw the pros and they were able to get that close and talk to them. And so I think it's a proper and it's a wonderful introduction to the sport for kids who have any kind of interest at all. I'm really very excited about it. I don't think it's a thing that's bad just because the Tour of Georgia doesn't have a title sponsor. You know, you see that happening in Europe all the time, and races that have been around for years and years and years sort of subside, and then somebody else comes in at the last minute and takes over the title sponsorship. As I was looking in some of the starts, and I'm thinking of St. Genevieve and some of the other little town squares, I think Sedalia was one, and there was another one. Of course, I can't think of the name of the town, but you look at the town squares and you see the festivals. Oh, it's the home of sliced bread, wherever that was.
Chillicothe.
And you look over the town squares, and it's so easy for me to picture, you know, 30, 40 years from now, you know, and it's got the same little feel as a Belgian town, you know, where the people just come down and they're there with grandpa and the grandkids and they've got all their favorite racers and they flock to the team introductions and stuff. It's there, you know, the venues are there and the interest is there enough to help it grow. But it's really important for people in the surrounding states to come out and make it happen big time. We're talking about putting together a tour bus from the Kim West Radio Cycling Show to follow the entire Tour of Missouri next year, because there are a number of people who came down in dribs and drabs and they'd show up and they'd party and so forth. But with me and the show having access to some of the riders, it makes it even more fun for them to realize, hey, this is a good way to spend a week. You can come down, you can pre-ride the courses, you can get to talk with the pros and find out, you know, what it's all about. And then you come back. I mean, our cyclocross season this year was outstanding. I mean, and each week we'd have training races during the week, and we had sponsored training race series. I mean, if you can believe that, we actually had sponsors from New Belgium Brewery on our Tuesday night training rides, for goodness sake, you know? And 20% or more of the riders that showed up for these things, and we'd have anywhere from 60 or 80 people on a Tuesday night show up for these renegade rides, they were new riders, you know? And we had between 15 and 20% of the participants at races who were women, most of whom were category four new racers. So I think the sport is really growing. It's just that it's having a little bit of a burp on the pro level, but that's only in the significance that the Tour of Georgia and the Tour of Missouri are getting the sponsorship struggles. But the rest of the sport is incredibly healthy. I'm pretty jazzed about it.
That's great.
I ride a lot of gravel roads around here, and I thought I was familiar with all the gravel events in the Midwest, but Midwest Gravel Road Marathon Championships. It's a new one on me. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Oh, that was a new event this year, and it's in conjunction with the Honey Creek Resort down on Lake Red Rock, and it's a private resort. Honey Creek is, but it's on the federal Lake Red Rock, and it's gorgeous, and they have wonderfully untouched gravel roads down there, and it's southeast of Des Moines, maybe an hour or so, and you get into some really, really nice, long, steep hills, and not much traffic at all. And so the folks put together this cycling weekend, and they were looking for something, some sort of a unique catchphrase, and something to make that race stand out from all the other gravel races that go on around here. They decided that a marathon gravel road race would be the thing to do. And so we did. And it was, oh, my goodness, it was an early cold experience. And but the routes were unbelievable. The wildlife was spectacular. I mean, we had big hawks and eagles and all sorts of birds, you know, in addition to herons and egrets and up and down roads that I'm not familiar with. I mean, I know roads in and around about a 50-mile radius of Des Moines, but this was new to me, and it's a fun event, and the Honey Creek Resort is really very cool. They got a bunch of little cabins, ideally suited to people if they want to bring a team down and get a deal on a cabin, and the team can stay in the cabin. You know, they hold them from 8 to 14 people. But next year we're going to have, it was just a race on Saturday. I think next year we're going to have the gravel road race championship, and then a cyclocross event to have a full weekend of racing. And that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. And you always like racing on new roads, you know, because now we know we got to go back down there sometime, just load up the bikes and go down, you know, maybe 10, 15 of us, and just ride these roads.
Awesome. And how'd you do in the race?
I was the winner of the Masters Edition, so that's where I get the title of Grand Master of the Midwest Gravel Marathon Gravel Road Race. I like big titles.
How many bikes do you
have? It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've got a basement full of bikes. And it started off. I learned from collecting records as a college student. You know, the only time you sell one, you regret it and you miss it. And so I decided not to make that mistake with bicycles. And so I've got just about every old race bike I've ever had, which is great because then you've got a training time trial bike, and you've got all sorts of training cyclocross bikes, and you've got gravel bikes, and you've got townies, and then I've got this slew of fat tired, you know, single speed and three speed Schwinns and balloon type bikes like that. And I've got, oh my goodness, I've got some Stingrays. I've got a, you know, boy Stingray kickback, and I've got the My Fair Lady Little Girl's Stingray. And then I managed to find a few years ago a mini twin, which is a Stingray tandem. And and this one is a prototype. They made them in 1968, and the one I've got is a prototype for 1969, which they didn't make. It's a three-speed, and it's just the most fun bike I've got. But it's not the kind of bike you want to ride for more than 15, 20 miles, you know. But then I've got you know, other tandems, regular, you know, and racing tandems, and and BMX bikes and what have you. But, you know, the nice thing is you have friends come over, and a lot of my friends are racers that are younger that have never ridden on an old cruiser before. And you get on an old cruiser, and then their eyes light up like a little kid, which is what cycling is all about. If it's not fun, you shouldn't be doing it, you know. And so I like to have bikes for all occasions.
Sounds like you're going to have a museum of bikes with that collection. That's
yeah.
I haven't heard. I remember the Stingray. I hadn't heard that term in a long time.
Oh, yeah. And if you look, you know, do a Google search, image search for Mini Twin, you'll see them. But they're all single or two speed, and they were made at the request of a woman whose husband came back injured from Vietnam, and he had balance issues and couldn't swing his leg over a full-size bike. And so she convinced the folks at Twin, which, you know, what a nice responsive corporation. They came out with a Stingray tandem so that the husband could ride at the back and the wife could steer and all that kind of stuff. And, the little thing is, oh, my God, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. But I've got work bikes, and I've got old Schwinn's with Springer front ends and all that kind of stuff, you know, so it's whatever I feel like riding, a lot of fixed gears and what have you. So.
Well, I think Randy and I are going to have to come on the road here and see this. That'd be,
and my understanding, there's going to be some sort of a cruiser ride coming up in town this weekend. So I'm thinking, yeah, let me know what's up, you know, because I'll be able to outfit a few folks. I've got like maybe 10 or 12 old cruisers, you know, that type of cruisers like that, you know, just fun.
Well, Kim, we learned that your Iowa's 50 plus age group rider of the year. Congratulations, and tell us a little bit more about this award and when you received it.
I was kind of surprised. I was out at the bike shop getting my cyclocross bike fixed, and one of the mechanics there said, hey, congratulations on rider of the year. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, but it turns out that, you know, I mean, I had a fairly good season. I still am not racing. I didn't win every race, so I'm still not there yet. But I raced a lot, and I was pretty consistently in the top three or four, you know, and when I first started racing in the 80s, I'd race 50, 60 times a year. And, you know, that was back when you could do stage races and get three or four races on a weekend, or do, you know, I could do 30, 40, 50 plus and get three races in a day and stuff like that. Because the way I figured is the only way you get better is race more, you know. And so I have that kind of season. I don't know how many times I race, but, you know, we start off racing gravel races in March, and you know, you finish up a cyclocross in November. And so they tallied up the results, and it turned out that I had, you know, like almost 400 points and almost 100-point lead on second place. And I thought, well, that's cool. And the nice thing is, I mean, yeah, it's nice for me personally, but our team, all9yards.com racing team, we won first place in the category 1-2. We won first place in the category 3. First place in the category 4. We don't have any category 5 riders. We don't have any women riders, and we don't, frankly, have anybody that races 30 plus or 40 plus on a regular basis. So every race division that we compete in, we won rider of the year, and I'm very, very proud of our team effort for being that. It's a bunch of guys that have been together for a long time, and I'm pretty psyched. So we're on fire. I mean, we race, and that's what it's all about. So I was happy to do my part for the team. It's good.
That's wonderful. Well, congratulations. Well, our time's coming to an end. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners about the radio show or any other thing about bicycling?
Oh, boy. You know, I love doing the radio show, and I close out every week with a little tagline saying, you know, Creature coffee maker, well, ride your bike with a friend, and those are pretty important things. You know, I mean, if you love cycling, it's a shame to do it by yourself. You know, get as many people involved as possible, and I always like to urge people to sit down with a bowl of popcorn and listen to the radio show. You know, we've got a lot of people who you know, download on Mondays and either listen at work, which I think is great. You know, if you can blow off time at work to listen to my show, I'm pretty happy about that. But a lot of people take it on bike rides with them and so forth. But I'm always open to ideas for the show. You know, they can just get me at KimWest@KXNO.com and give me your ideas for anything. Because I cover everything, not just racing. I mean, I cover trails, advocacy, bikes and kids and all that kind of nonsense. And, you know, we've got shows coming up with Steve Head and things like that. We talk about that kind of stuff. But I'm also really excited about talking with, you know, more and more pros in on all levels. You know, we've got Dave Weens and Travis Brown. Dave has been on before. Travis Brown is coming up again. We're going to have more shows with Tyler Hamilton. And that's opening the doors for more and more people to appear on the show, because they look at that and go, oh, yeah, well, that's cool, you know. And so it's easier. And now as my friends become pros, it makes it easier for me to talk with these people and then in turn relay that information back to the listeners. And that's the kind of stuff I think that is going to help cycling gain a little bit of prominence, a little bit of attention, and a little bit more solid audience and fan base. It's not just for me. Clearly, if I was doing it for glory, I'd be doing something else. But you know, I think my enthusiasm for cycling comes through in the nonsense that I do, and I hope to infect other people to do the same thing.
Well, that's very clear. Well, Kim, thanks so much for being on the podcast, and we really do appreciate your time, all your bicycle advocacy efforts, and really with the continued success with the Kim West Radio Hour.
Well, and good luck to you guys too. I'm always happy to see that there's more people out there listening, because that means there's more people out there listening, you know. And we only gain legitimacy when we gain numbers. So I thank you guys for doing what you do too. And it's been fun talking, clearly. So thanks a lot.
Take care. We appreciate you downloading episode 14 of the Kansas Cyclist Podcast, and we do hope that you will subscribe so that you will not miss out on future episodes. We have a lot of interesting news, information, bicycle safety tips, and interviews that we have planned for future episodes, so please come back. Also, take the time and leave your feedback, or if you are interested in becoming a sponsor, please write or send your audio file to podcast@kansascyclist.com or call us at 913-938-6855. Remember, there are show notes on the website, which include links to all the news, rides, trails, bicycle safety tips, and interviews that have been discussed on each podcast. We would like to thank Mark Fransky for allowing us to use his song called Brush Creek Crossing as our theme music. Take care and cycle safe.